Succession number 28639, Reel 7.
So my wife came with me, went to on a holiday, went there, and the Missouri is just alongside there, the ship. And the Marines that got us out was from the Missouri. So I said to her, I want to go on board that ship. So she made inquiries, my wife did, and we got permission to go on board. They took us on board, and the guy that showed me around was about my age at the time. So I said, he was no longer in the Navy. So I said, how come you showing us around? He said, well, this is my old ship. He said, I was on her when she was in Japan. And I said, well, it was your Marines that got me out of my prison camp. And he started to cry. We both hugged each other. He said, I'll never forget the sight I saw when I saw you people. He said, it was quite awful to see you all on the side, to think that these bastards treated you so badly. And that was the first really real response I got of how I looked like years afterwards when I met this guy. And until he died, he wrote to me constantly. That was from 10 years ago. Anyway, back to Manila again. You wanted to ask me questions about Okinawa.
No, Jack Hewson, Reel 7. Just going on to the reel. So, yeah. Okinawa, yeah, we went through the treatment there. Is there anything special that sticks in your mind about Okinawa?
No, not really. Manila.
I was just thinking of Okinawa and the bands that play.
That was right, that was it. Well, there was one occasion that you were interested in. I think it was Tommy Dorsey started to play Roll Out the Barrel, and I started to cry, something awful. And they asked me, what's the matter? I said, please, ask someone to stop that. I explained to him, I said, we used to have to bury our comrades in bloody barrels, these soya bean barrels. I said, no, don't. And I hate that song. It still brings tears to mind. It's got the number of barrels that I saw with human beings in it being burned. How can I enjoy Roll Out the Barrel anymore? No, I hate that song. I really do hate it. That was one of my experiences from the Manila. And when I went to...
Sorry, Okinawa.
Okinawa, really. Right. When I went to Manila, I told them, I said, please, if there's a band playing, please ask them not to play. And they made sure they didn't play it from then on.
And you must have been very fragile, I suppose. Obviously.
Oh, of course I was. I was very temperamental, too. Very, flashback, you know. I'm going to mood very quickly. Even with the Americans, I used to get ratty with them, and I would explode and say, "For God's sake!" You know, I used to tell them to stop it, and they all of them had been briefed on it because they knew how to handle me. But that was quite common in Okinawa and in Manila. I was like that all the time, and again in Singapore, because when they finished the examination in Manila, they told me the same thing. You're not going to be able to father children. So they said, you're now being handed over to the British in Singapore. And they flew us again by an... this time they put us on a British ship, a warship, came in and picked us up in Manila. And it was a wireless ship, which called HMS Midlothian, it was called. And that took us to Singapore. And I was put in hospital there for another week. And while I was in hospital there, I lay in this hospital. I remember my bed was by a window, and I looked right onto the seashore. And I could see Japanese POWs being handled by the British. And they were made to load sandbags. God knows what they're doing with sandbags. But they were making them work like hell, and I enjoyed every minute of that, see these bloody ex-Japanese soldiers being worked to death by our own Tommies. But I was there and had the same tests, and they told me the same things. It was more or less the recurrence of Manila and Okinawa, that, all the way through. Same with the same thing. And then I was put on a hospital ship, and that took nearly 6 weeks to come home, which meant that took me getting on for 10 weeks before I got home.
So we're now in sort of probably beginning of August.
That's right.
1945.
Oh no, August was when the.
No, that was VE Day.
Yeah, August. It was September. End of September.
Of course.
End of September.
End of September, beginning of October. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Because I eventually got home to Southampton about the first week in October.
And how are you looking now? Were you, had you put on weight?
Well, we were still on the invalid diets, as they call. We had to build our stomachs up. Our stomachs had shrunk so much, it would have been catastrophic to have fed us a proper English meal. So all the way home, we were on diets, special diets, leading up slowly. Our breakfast, on each time I went to a hospital on the way home, they started all over again. That was what annoyed me more than anything. We started off in Okinawa with a slice of toast and a cherry on it. And that was all we had for breakfast. And then that was every morning. Then in Manila, it was two slices of toast and a piece of a banana or an apple on the top, cooked apple on the top. And then when we got to Singapore, they started all over with one slice of toast. I said, I've been through this, we're starving for this time. But no, they insisted on the proper medication, being British. So it was the same thing all over again. And by the time I went on the hospital ship, it was back to a reasonable diet again, but I was still well under 6 stone. God. So, and on the way home, of course, I was treated as a patient all the way home. I was in beds, and no tests on the ship. They just give us special diets all the way home. And eventually I arrived in Southampton, and this is an interesting part of my home country. No flag waving. I was the only naval chap on this ship. The rest were all military and RAF. And there was no one there to meet this hospital ship, nobody. The purser on board the ship had to get in touch with the military people, who in touch eventually got in. All this time we were left on the ship. Transports kept coming on, picking up people, taking them off. And I was still there at the end. I was the only one left on this hospital ship. I said, what about me? They said, well, what was your depot? I said, Portsmouth. So they phoned Portsmouth. They didn't know anything about me. But they sent a jeep with a naval driver to pick me up. And by the way, I was still in American uniform. I didn't have a hat, just American uniform, because I'd lost, the Americans gave us clothing to wear on the way home. And it was looked baggy on me. For as thin as it was to them, it was still baggy on me. And I got into this jeep, and I had no kit or anything, so the chap said, where's your kit? He said, are you an American? I said, no, I'm not an American, I haven't got any kit. I told him what had happened, you see, and he said, oh, my God. He was only a youngster. He didn't even know about what had happened to us in Japan, I don't think. Anyway, by the time I got halfway through, I was telling him we were approaching the entrance to Portsmouth depot when this young PO got out, a youngster got out, held his hand up, stopped the jeep. He said, what are you doing? And pointed to me. I said, I'm going in the depot. I'm not dressed like that, you're not. Get out, he said. So he said to the chap, being a young sailor, on your way in. So he took me into his little office, guardhouse office sort of thing. And he said, what are you doing dressed in American uniform? I said, well, he said, are you Navy? Before I could answer it, he said, are you Navy? I said, yes, American Navy. I said, no, I'm British Navy. He said, well, where's your bloody uniform? I said, well, as far as I can recall, it's back in Hong Kong. He said, well, you bloody well better go back and get it because you're not coming in here without it. And it was at that point that a naval commander walked into the office and said, what's all the noise about? Looking at me. And he said, who are you? I said, well, I'm trying to tell this petty officer who I am, but I said, I haven't been able to tell him yet. He said, well, who are you? I said, I'm a Japanese ex-POW on my way home. If there'd been a hole for that petty officer to jump into, he'd have jumped into it, believe me. He must have felt so humiliated. So I said, oh, my God, he says, I can understand why you're now in the American. Come with me. So he took me to the sick bay in the depot there. And they had no records of me there, no flagway, nothing. And at the stage, I said, could I have a meal, please, because I'm bloody hungry. So then thought of even that. So they gave me, I always remember, it was a Cornish pasty, one of your Cornish pasty. And I enjoyed every second of it. And he then said, well, we'll give you a medical while we're waiting. We'll get in touch with the naval hospital in Portsmouth, the big naval hospital there. They should have your records out. And within an hour, a doctor arrived with all my records. He said, we've been waiting for this guy to come, but we had no idea how he was coming home because there'd been no communications between us. So the whole situation had been so confused. So he said, we know who you are, Mr. Yost. He said, you are an you're an HO. He said, so you will be no mob now. You'll be given a demob suit and you'll be sent home. So he says, but you have to be examined first. So they took me up to the hospital And for once, they gave me a bit of medical attention. I was only there just one day, really, because they confirmed, by that time, the records had arrived from the other places as well. And they said, we confirmed everything you were told. He said, your hands will heal in time. He said, but you'll be taken care of, he says, in Edinburgh. He said, we'll look after that. We'll call you in periodically to look at that. But you will be removed immediately. He said, the money will be sent, your back money will be sent to your home. Because there were no banks in those days. Nobody had checkbooks in those days. At least in the early part of the war, anyway. And he said, we'll give you a NAFI voucher to have a meal on the way home and a train voucher. So they took me to this train, and this was incredible. This, I got on the train. I was still dressed in American uniform because I tried on that the mob suit, and it was a double-breasted thing that looked like an overcoat on me. And I said, it didn't fit me. He says, the only one we've got, you'll have to take it because we've got no demob seats left. You're very lucky you had one left. I said, well, I don't want it. It's no use to me. Can I have permission to travel in my American? He said, yes, but you have to take your demob suit because we've got to sign. You've got to sign for it. So I had to sign for all the things, little things they gave me, including a voucher. And they took me by transport to the train. They put me on the train, all right. And they say, you'll have to change trains at Crewe. But he says, there'll be someone there to look after me. But as usual, when I got to nobody there to look after me, I came out and I just stopped the chap. I said, I showed him my voucher for Edinburgh. He said, oh, well, he said, you've got at least an hour to wait for your train here. So he said, what do I do in the meantime? He said, well, there's a coffee by there. Well, I had no money. I had this voucher. I went, tried to present it to this wagon. He says, no. He said, we're not a NAFI. I'm sorry. So I said, oh, well, I said, I'd had a good breakfast before I left the hospital, so I'll manage. So but I was still hungry. So I was standing there waiting for this train when a guy came down. I don't know if I met him, still don't know. He was a complete stranger to me. He came down with a little handle, thick sort of case. And he laid his case on one of the trolleys, the railway trolley things, platform trolleys. And he went and got a cup of coffee and a sandwich in a piece of paper or a little, whatever it was, cover thing. And he came over and put the cup of coffee on the trolley behind his case. And I was standing there looking at this coffee, you know. And he was about to take he was about to take the sandwich to his mouth when there was a loudspeaker announcement. The train starting in platform 4 is about to leave. And he dropped that sandwich and ran, and I caught that sandwich before it hit the platform. As soon as I'm sitting here, I caught it before it hit the platform. And I ate it and had his coffee. And then I got the next train to Edinburgh. And when I got out to Edinburgh, I had already told them by police, I think I told you that, by telephone. I phoned the Edinburgh Police in Portsmouth, from the hospital in Portsmouth, told them to go to my mother, she didn't have a telephone. Would they tell her that I'd be approximately on this train and leaving Edinburgh, having to change at Crewe? So I got out the platform at Edinburgh and walked up. Saw my mother coming towards me. I recognised her straight away. But she walked right past me. She didn't recognise me. I had to go after her and say, Mum, it's me. And she looked at me. Mind you, the American uniform didn't help. But she looked at me and said, my God, son, what have they done to you? And we just cried in each other's arms. That was my homecoming. That was my ending to our Japanese escapade.
God, what a story.
Yeah, no cheering, no flag waving for me. That was it. And I joined the civil service eventually.
Was there any attempt to interview you immediately? I mean,
no consultation, no.
War crimes?
No.
To identify
nothing like that. They told me in every state in America, each place in America, that was one of the questions I got, in Okinawa, Manila, Singapore, and again on the hospital ship when I left, and again when I left the military hospital or naval hospital in Portsmouth. Go home, for God's sake, and forget, try to forget all about it. And of course, since I've been here with all my nightmares, since I left and came to live in this house with my wife, I had all these damn nightmares. Even before I came to live here in London, and so I had awful nightmares. And they got worse as the years went by.
They got worse. They didn't
get
better.
Oh, they did. Yeah, they did. And it was all because when I eventually had to go up to Leatherhead for treatment, they said, that's the worst medical advice you could have had, was to forget it because you've been storing all up inside of you. That's got to come out. Somehow or other, we've got to get it out of you. And we will do here in Leatherhead because that's our job. And they did that over 20 years and going up to Leatherhead. They did that for me.
Was it a form of psychoanalysis? Or?
Oh, it was all sorts of different things. There was group therapy where not only people who'd be similar experiences to me, but there was doctors and psychiatrists mixed in with them, asking me all sorts of questions and taking note of the answers and working on them from then on by direct. There was other days they would have me singly then in a single room all to myself and go through what I'd said. And this went on for years at combat stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, they call it. Now, even people in offices, it makes me laugh when I think what I went through with it. So that was
absolutely
it.
Absolutely no provision at all for people after the war.
No, none at all.
Nothing. You've been through this back, and that was it.
No, while I was in here at Leatherhead, the last occasion, by the way, just 2 years ago, because I haven't been up since because of my wife's illness, but the doctor, Booth still comes to see me, the wireless with the welfare officer still comes to see me from there. And they want me to go back in as soon as Pat's well enough. She's going to come with me. They've gone back up. Because they want me as a model in there for other people who won't take the treatment. And I'm all for anything to help my comrades.
Absolutely.
These poor buggers in Iraq, it's terrible for them, really.
Yeah.
It's not as if they're defending their own country, is it? It's very similar to what I went through, really. Not knowing what's going to happen on the next day to them. And so, there it is.
Well, thank you, Jack. That was one. One thing I wanted to ask you. Did you have any contact with home when you were in the camps? With your home? Did your mother know you were alive? Were there any letters?
No, none whatsoever, no. It's only since I've been in Leatherhead. One of the things I did for them there was a professor came up from London University, apparently. I can't remember his name, but John Booth will know. Came up and he wanted to interview ex-Far East prisoners of war. And Mary, who was the head nurse at the time, asked me if I would do it. And I said, yes, anything to help the combat stress people because they've been so good to me. She said, well, you go along, Jack. And he asked me about my experience, something like you just done, but didn't go as deep into them as you did. But when he finished, he said, well, is there any way you can suggest we can improve what you went through and having to come to combat stress? I said, yes. This combat stress has done so much for me too bloody late in life. You don't mind me saying so. I said, I could have been a much better person much earlier in life if we had something like this at the beginning. He said, it was still here, but it's obviously never been used. He said, what do you suggest? I said, well, why can't people coming back from Iraq or the Gulf or any of these horrible places that our troops are having to go to nowadays, why can't they come home and have a consultation initially, find out how they've reacted to it, and from there on, get them in for treatment like they've given me. And they take a note of it. Hopefully they'll do something about it.
Because, I mean, I know, I also work in, I'll tell you, I mean, I worked on there was a Channel 4 documentary called Battleshot, I forget. I was the researcher on that. And this was to do with people who'd come back from the Falklands War.
Oh, yes, right.
And we talked to a lot of people, and even then, as recently as that, 1983, there was absolutely no provision for people who'd been in that horrific, you know, bits of nothing.
That's
first,
right.
Like your experience.
But still horrific, nevertheless.
And they came back and then marriages started breaking up and people
I know, that's right. That's our problem just now with the people. Or it was. It's not so bad now. We're getting old. A lot of them are dying of natural deaths nowadays. But a hell of a lot of them, their marriages never... Our own Padre, by the way, down in Plymouth here, John Alf Baker. Now, his wife left him because of the treatment, and he married again. He married his nurse in the end, who's still looking after him, and he's our padre.
And because, because people took to the bottle, they abused their wives, people were in such a terrible emotional state.
That's exactly.
How did you adapt back to civvy life then?
Well, once I had my wife, what really made my wife do something about it was, I woke up night when I had my wife's hand around her throat, she thought I was trying to kill my own wife. Because the one that had stood by me so well. And it was all because I went in for a hip operation. Because, oh, by the way, my knee was so bad when I came back. They kept telling me I'd have to live with it. And it was only when I went up to Leatherhead doctor look at, I still had a splint on my knee by all these years. It was only a kneecap thing, you know, that was a very modern splint that I had to keep my legs straight. So I was called Hoppy for years. But when I went, first of all, up to Comrade Treth Leatherhead 20 years ago to be the day, first thing that Dr. Lucas up there said to me, he said, why haven't you done something about that bloody knee of yours? He said, I've just had it x-rayed. And he said, you've been walking with no cartilage in your knee. How do you manage to walk on it? I said, because of the splint, doctor. He said, but that's not good. He said, that was war-related. That should have been seen to as soon as possible after you came home. So that's another example of the treatment we got when we first came home.
But they did it. They fixed it eventually.
But he insisted on it straight away. He said, what's your doctor's name? And can you give the address of the main hospital in Exeter? So he wrote to our doctor here, who wasn't very pleased about the contents of the letter, I'll tell you. It was partly my fault for not telling him. It was war-related. But Dr. Leader is still here today. And copy of the letter went to the hospital. And I'll never forget the final paragraph letter. If you can hear your way to have Mr. Hewson into hospital for an immediate operation on his knee within the next 7 days, I want to know now, within the 7 days, so I can have him in to Aldershot Hospital, where they have the finest orthopaedic surgeons in the country, and he will be attended to immediately. And Leader was furious about this. He sent for me straight away, he was my own doctor. And when I went in to see him, I said, I know what you're going to do, but don't challenge me, because nothing to do with me. I said, I went in there to Leatherhead completely blind, as I was when I first came into you, doctor. If you had asked me these questions like Dr. Luca had said, I could have answered you, but you didn't. So he said, yes, I accept that. And before he could get on to me, he had to apologise.
And you had it done on the National Health?
And I had it done. I was in that hospital the following week.
Fantastic.
And I got first-class treatment in Exeter Hospital. And they took the whole knee out. They said, your knee is so bad, the whole lot's got to come out. And they put a complete new knee in, and it's been wonderful.
Is there anything else now that you think we haven't covered? Is there anything that comes to mind now that you think I should have asked you about that you haven't talked about?
I can't think of anything.
It's been very extensive.
My hip. By the way, when they did my knee, and also this is partly due to combat stress, John Booth, whom you just met, Colonel Booth, rather. They told me at the time, Dr. Lucas said, he said, you've been walking so much, limping for years on this leg, it's going to affect your left leg eventually. He said, probably your hip first and then your knee next. He said, each time, don't forget, it's on your records, war-related, so you bring it up straight away to your doctor. He said, but if you're on the same doctor, it'll be on his records now, thanks to me. I said, I know it won't. I'll never forget this doctor. He's no longer a doctor there, but he was very pro Japanese POWs, because he knew, he'd seen others, he'd been what they'd been through, and he knew what to expect. And I was very lucky there, because some of the people who had seen him before me really made him aware of what he was getting on his neck. But anyway, as soon as the hip started to give me trouble, I went and saw Leader straight away, and in no time at all I was into hospital, and a new hip there.
Great.
So,
I think we've more or less...
I got a war pension, by the way, thanks to Leatherhead. Up till then, I had no pension, nothing.
So you were just, you demobbed, you were out.
I was out. That was the end of it. Absolutely nothing. I had no pension or nothing.
Extraordinary.
It was just after my wife really got me the pension, by telling the welfare officer who was coming, John Chambers, who I'm still in touch with today. And I've got so much to thank him for, apart from getting myself sorted out, my knee sorted out, he also got me my pension, really, because Dr. Lucas said, why aren't you on a war pension, for God's sake, man, after what you've been through? I said, that's because we've got no consultation, no one helped us at all.
Extraordinary.
We're just a forgotten army, as we're well known for.
Exactly, exactly. Going back, one question I meant to ask you, the ship that went down that was transporting you from Hong Kong to Japan, when you were torpedoed, how many survived?
Oh, yes, there was 1,812 of us. As far as I know, there was only 800 of us actually survived the sinking, but there's only 400 survived after that. By the time we got to Japan, a lot more had died as a result of the sinking and being kept on as a prisoner. So I was one of 400 survivors at the end of the war, out of 1,800.
Did you ever meet any of those people again?
Oh, yes. And we also met the chap who was in command of the submarine that sunk us. He apparently had to leave the Navy eventually because of post-traumatic stress disorder after he was told that he had sunk the Lisbon Maru full of Japanese POWs. And it affected him so much that he asked to be taken off and sent home. And he came and he cried with us. He got up at the reunion at Bournemouth where I met that ex-nurse. I met everybody there. My wife and I were told we had to go to this reunion because everything was going to happen to us, things that we never expected. This I'm going back now 10 years now, maybe more than that, that one reunion. And this naval officer was there, American. We couldn't understand because he knew his uniform was a bit tight on him. And we knew he wasn't a present-day naval officer. But eventually, they got on the microphone and they said, "Are there any people here, survivors, from the sinking of the Lisbon Maru?" Now, I wondered, am I the only one? I'm not going to put my hand up, not knowing what was going to happen. But when I saw a couple of others put their hand up, I put my hand up, and there was about six of us there. I didn't know this at the time. And we all went out on the floor, and he came to approach us with the microphone. And he said, "I've come here," he said, "to say how terribly sorry I am to do what I did to you poor devils." He said, "I didn't honestly know you were in that ship. I looked through the periscope and all I could see was a Japanese freighter with a gun forward and a gun aft. To me, that was an armed merchant ship." And he said, "When the moment I heard that you were on board and we even left you," he said, "some of you I know got out into the water. God knows how you survived." He said, "But thank God you did." He said, "I've come all this way to say how sorry I am. All big tears in my eyes. Sorry, Nick."
"It's okay, it's okay.
Can't help it." Because that was so nice of him to do that, come all the way, paid his own fares. And he said he was a sick man now because of it.
Sure.
He got invalided out of the American Navy because of it. Because they affected him.
You've been back to Japan since.
Yes, I have.
When you left Japan, what was your feeling about the Japanese when you left? Absolute contempt and hatred.
When I left in 1945, I hated everything Japanese, and I was terrified. I don't mind admitting that I was terrified of anything Japanese. Just the sign, Japanese writing, was enough to call shivers down my spine. And to see a Japanese on television was, I just had to switch off. And the worst part came then when we had relatives down when I was a civil servant in London, in my early days, when I was still having the nightmares, by the way. We were at, my wife took us to the big palace, Henry VIII's palace, Hampton Court. And while we were in Hampton Court, there was this Japanese